Ecce Homo by Friedrich Nietzsche. Translator's Introduction. Ecce Homo is the last prose work that Nietzsche wrote. It is true that the pamphlet Nietzsche contra Wagner was prepared a month later than the autobiography, but we cannot consider this pamphlet as anything more than a compilation, seeing that it consists entirely of aphorisms drawn from such previous works as Joyful Wisdom, Beyond Good and Evil, The Genealogy of Morals, etc. Coming at the end of a year in which he had produced The Case of Wagner, The Twilight of the Idols, and The Antichrist, Ecce Homo is not only a coping stone worthy of the wonderful creations of that year, but also a fitting conclusion to his whole life, in the form of a grand summing up of his character as a man, his purpose as a reformer, and his achievement as a thinker. As if half conscious of his approaching spiritual end, Nietzsche here bids his friends farewell, just in the manner in which, in The Twilight of the Idols, Aphorism 36, Part 9, he declares that everyone should be able to take leave of his circle of relatives and intimates when his time seems to have come, that is to say, while he is still himself. While he still knows what he is about, and is able to measure his own life and life in general, and speak of both in a manner which is not vouchsafed to the groaning invalid, to the man lying on his back, decrepit and exhausted, or to the moribund victim of some wasting disease. Nietzsche's spiritual death, like his whole life, was in singular harmony with his doctrine. He died suddenly and proudly, sword in hand. War, which he, and he alone among all the philosophers of Christendom, had praised so wholeheartedly, at last struck him down in the full vigour of his manhood, and left him a victim on the battlefield, the terrible battlefield of thought, on which there is no quarter, and for which no Geneva Convention has yet been established, or even thought of. To those who know Nietzsche's life work, no apology will be needed for the form and content of this wonderful work. They will know, at least, that a man either is or is not aware of his significance and of the significance of what he has accomplished, and that if he is aware of it, then self-realization, even of the kind which we find in these pages, is neither morbid nor suspicious, but necessary and inevitable. Such chapter headings as Why I Am So Wise, Why I Am a Fatality, Why I Write Such Excellent Books, however much they may have disturbed the equanimity and objectivity in particular of certain Nietzsche biographers, can be regarded as pathological only in a democratic age in which people have lost all sense of gradation and rank, and in which the virtues of modesty and humility had to be preached far and wide as a corrective against the vulgar pretensions of thousands of wretched nobodies. For little people can be endured only as modest citizens or humble Christians. If, however, they demand a like modesty on the part of the truly great, if they raise their voices against Nietzsche's lack of the very virtue they so abundantly possess, or pretend to possess, it is time to remind them of Goethe's famous remark, Nur die Lupen sind bescheiden. Only nobodies are ever modest. It took Nietzsche barely 3 weeks to write this story of his life. Begun on the 15th of October 1888, his 44th birthday, it was finished on the 4th of November of the same year, and, but for a few trifling modifications and additions, is just as Nietzsche left it. it was not published in Germany until the year 1908, 8 years after Nietzsche's death. In a letter dated the 27th of December 1888, addressed to the musical composer Fuchs, the author declares the object of the work to be to dispose of all discussion, doubt, and inquiry concerning his own personality, in order to leave the public mind free to consider merely the things for the sake of which he existed. Die Dinge, deren wegen ich da bin. And, true to his intention, Nietzsche's honesty in these pages is certainly one of the most remarkable features about them. From the first chapter, in which he frankly acknowledges the decadent elements within him, to the last page, whereon he characterizes his mission, his life task, and his achievement by means of the one symbol, Dionysus versus Christ. Everything comes straight from the shoulder, without hesitation, without fear of consequences, and above all, without concealment. Only in one place does he appear to conceal something, and then he actually leads one to understand that he is doing so. It is in regard to Wagner, the greatest friend of his life. "Who doubts," he says, "that I, old artillery man that I am, would be able, if I liked, to point my heavy guns at Wagner?" But he adds, "Everything decisive in this question I kept to myself. I have loved Wagner." Page 122. To point, as many have done, to the proximity of all Nietzsche's autumn work of the year 1888 to his breakdown at the beginning of 1889, and to argue that in all its main features it foretells the catastrophe that is imminent, seems a little too plausible, a little too obvious, and simple to require refutation. That Nietzsche really was in a state which in medicine is known as euphoria, that is to say, that state of highest well-being and capacity, which often precedes a complete breakdown, cannot, I suppose, be questioned. For his style, his penetrating vision, and his vigour reached the zenith in the works written in this autumn of 1888. But the contention that the matter, the substance of these works, reveals any signs whatsoever of waning mental health, or, as a certain French biographer has it, of an inability to hold himself and his judgments in check, is best contradicted by the internal evidence itself. To take just a few examples at random, examine the cold and calculating tone of self-analysis in Chapter 1 of the present work. Consider the reserve and the restraint with which the idea in Aphorism 7 of that chapter is worked out, not to speak of the restraint and self-mastery in the idea itself, namely, to be one's enemy's equal. This is the first condition of an honourable duel. Where one despises, one cannot wage war. Where one commands, where one sees something beneath one, one ought not to wage war. My war tactics can be reduced to four principles. First, I attack only things that are triumphant. If necessary, I wait until they become triumphant. Secondly, I attack only those things against which I find no allies, against which I stand alone, against which I compromise nobody but myself. Thirdly, I never make personal attacks. I use a personality merely as a magnifying glass, by means of which I render a general but elusive and scarcely noticeable evil more apparent. Fourthly, I attack only those things from which all personal differences are excluded, in which any such thing as a background of disagreeable experiences is lacking. And now notice the gentleness with which, in Chapter 2, Wagner, the supposed mortal enemy and the supposed envied rival to Nietzsche, is treated. Are these the words and the thoughts of a man who has lost, or who is losing, control? And even if we confine ourselves simply to the substance of this work and put the question, is it a new Nietzsche or the old Nietzsche that we find in these pages? Is it the old countenance with which we are familiar, or are the features distorted, awry, disfigured? What will the answer be? Obviously, there is no new or even deformed Nietzsche here, because he is still faithful to the position which he assumed in Thus Spake Zarathustra 5 years previously, and is perfectly conscious of this fidelity. See page 141. Neither can he be even on the verge of any marked change, because the whole of the third chapter, in which he reviews his life work, is simply a reiteration and a confirmation of his old points of view, which are here made all the more telling by additional arguments suggested, no doubt, by maturer thought. In fact, if anything at all is new in this work, it is its cruel certainty, its severe deliberateness, and its extraordinarily incisive vision, as shown, for instance, in the summing up of the genuine import of the third and fourth essays in the Thoughts Out of Season, pages 75 to 76, 80, 81, and 82. A summing up which a most critical analysis of the essays in question can but verify. Romanticism, idealism, Christianity are still scorned and despised. Another outlook, a nobler, braver, and more earthly outlook, is still upheld and revered. The great yea to life, including all that it contains that is terrible and questionable, is still pronounced in the teeth of pessimists, nihilists, anarchists, Christians, and other decadents. And Germany, Europe's flatland, is still subjected to the most relentless criticism. If there are any signs of change, besides those of mere growth, in this work, they certainly succeed in eluding the most careful search, undertaken with a full knowledge of Nietzsche's former opinions, and it would be interesting to know precisely where they are found by those writers whom the titles of the chapters alone seem so radically to have perturbed. But the most striking thing of all, the miracle, so to speak, of this autobiography, is the absence from it of that loathing, that suggestion of surfeit, with which a life, such as the one Nietzsche had led, would have filled any other man, even of power approximate to his own. This anchorite, who, in the last years of his life as a healthy human being, suffered the experience of seeing even his oldest friends, including Rhoda, show the most complete indifference to his lot, this wrestler with fate, for whom recognition, in the persons of Branners, Taine, and Strindberg, have come all too late, and whom even support, sympathy, and help, arriving as it did at last, through Deussen, and from Madame de Salis Marchand, could no longer cheer or comfort. This was the man who was able, notwithstanding, to inscribe the device Amor Fati upon his shield on the very eve of his final collapse, as a victim of the unspeakable suffering he had endured. And this final collapse might easily have been foreseen. Nietzsche's sensorium, as his autobiography proves, was probably the most delicate instrument ever possessed by a human being. And with his fragile structure, the prerequisite, by the by, of all genius, his terrible will compelled him to confront the most profound and most recondite problems. We happen to know from another artist and profound thinker, Benjamin Disraeli, who himself had experienced a dangerous breakdown, what the consequences precisely are of indulging in excessive activity in the sphere of the spirit, more particularly when that spirit is highly organized. Disraeli says in Contarini Fleming, Part 4, Chapter 5, I have sometimes half believed, although the suspicion is mortifying, that there is only one step between his state, who deeply indulges in imaginative meditation, and insanity. For I will remember that at this period of my life, when I indulge in meditation to a degree that would now be impossible, and I hope unnecessary, my senses sometimes appear to be wandering. And artists are the proper judges of artists, not Oxford dons like Dr. Schiller, who, in his impudent attempt at dealing with something for which his pragmatic hands are not sufficiently delicate, eagerly avails himself of popular help in his article on Nietzsche in the 11th edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, and implies the hackneyed and wholly exploded belief that Nietzsche's philosophy is madness in the making. As German philosophers, however, are said to go to Oxford only when they die, we may, perhaps, conclude from this want of appreciation in that quarter how very much alive Nietzsche's doctrine still is. Not that Nietzsche went mad so soon, but that he went mad so late is the wonder of wonders, considering the extraordinary amount of work he did, the great task of the transvaluation of all values, which he actually accomplished, and the fact that he endured such long years of solitude, which to him, the sensitive artist to whom friends were everything, must have been a terrible hardship. We can only wonder at his great health, and can well believe his sister's account of the phenomenal longevity and bodily vigour of his ancestors. No one, however, who is initiated, no one who reads this work with understanding, will be in need of this introductory note of mine. For, to all who know, these pages must speak for themselves. We are no longer in the 19th century. We have learned many things since then, and if caution is only one of these things, at least it will prevent us from judging a book such as this one, with all its apparent pontifical pride and surging self-reliance, with undue haste, or with that arrogant assurance with which the ignorance of the humble and the modest has always confronted everything truly great. Anthony M. Ludovici. End of Translator's Introduction.